We are hereby beginning. So thank you very much for reminding me. That was something that was supposed to be on my to-do list. But in the meantime, once again, we're going to do Bereishit this time, more Torah next time, then survey through the prophets and the writings in the final 2 weeks with the goal of trying to get to what are the key principles that form the biblical thought on the land of Israel, knowing full well that some of these things are going to remain constant to now. And something's changed, because after all, there's been a lot of rabbinic thought in the last couple of thousand years, and that's going to change it, and that's why you're having however long of a series. This is a course where it's supposed to get us through, or get you through, I think, the modern period, and I think I can't wait to hear how it all goes. And if you're recording all of it, that means I could hear it, which is really, really exciting. It's important, I'll start with this, and again, feel free to raise your hand and stop me at any point about a conceptual idea or a text or whatever you're going to do. It's important that the Torah begins, we just started it this past Shabbat, how convenient, not in the land of Israel, and not with our people. You know, God could have written the Torah any way he wanted, and he chose to write it this way. The idea that it's starting way yonder and somewhere near Mesopotamiaville to a couple that has nothing to do with the people of Israel is not trivial. That's actually one of the most important points that the Torah is trying to set out. It reminds us that Israel is a land, but it's not the land of lands. God made the entire world. Not only that, but we have a very special relationship with God, no question about that. But that came later. The Torah doesn't want to say, oh, the world started in the land of Israel. The world started with the people of Israel. It could have done that, and it would have changed our perception of everything. Instead, we are meant to understand that we, the people of Israel, are part of a family of nations, and that God belongs to all of us, all humanity, not just us. That might seem obvious. I can't overstate it. It's such an important point. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, who lived in 16th century Italy, he introduces Bereishit with a point that... Am I okay?
Great.
Thumbs up. Great, thank you so much. At this point, I'm not certain that we have enough source sheets for everybody, which is a good problem to have. Something to note... Huh? Something to note for next time. But for our purposes now, even though I tend to be very pro-sharing for everything but source sheets for today, please, if you don't mind sharing, that would be great. And by next week, we'll already know to make more, and that will be great. Rabbi Ovadia Sforno opens up Sefer Bereishit, his commentary on Genesis, with the following comment. He says that the people of Israel was not God's plan A. Originally, all of humanity was supposed to be the chosen people. That's why God created Adam and Chava. Everybody is created in God's image. Everybody's supposed to be living in the Garden of Eden. But, and this is very prescient, he lived in the 16th century and did not know baseball, I'm sure of that. But he understood the concept of three strikes and you are out, and that's pretty much exactly how he says it, which is really cool. He talks about how Adam and Chava fail, so goodbye Garden of Eden, the generation of the flood fails, so goodbye all of them. And then Noah and his wife were supposed to build up a better world, but they failed, and the Tower of Babel was the final strike in that countdown. And that's the moment in chapter 11 of Bereishit where God says, that's it, I've had it. I'm not going to relate with humanity in that way anymore, but rather I'm going to choose the greatest individual on the planet, that being Abraham, who's going to found a nation that's supposed to teach humanity and lead them back to the Garden of Eden. And then the whole rest of Sefer Bereishit is... You realize it's not all of Abraham's family, right? It's that there's a filtering process where Abraham has 8 sons, even though there are only 2 famous ones, but there are 6 other ones who are born to a woman named Keturah. Yitzchak is the one who makes it, but then there's Yaakov and Esav gets filtered out along the way, and then you have Yaakov, and he has 12 sons, and for a very long while, I think that Yosef is going to be the one. Because Yaakov kind of hits you over the head with that and hits the other brothers over the head with that. And it's not until the very end of the book of Bereishit that you realize, oh, it's all 12 of them. And they found the nation. And that, of course, is consummated with Ma'amad Har Sinai. You have the slavery, you have the giving of the Torah. At that moment, there's an absolute covenantal relationship. So far, so good. Now, where does the land of Israel fit into this? Since, after all, this is about the land of Israel. When do we start hearing about the land of Israel belonging to our people? When Abraham goes Lech Lecha, very good. And specifically, that is the first place, specifically once he gets there. Right? God doesn't tell Abraham when he's over in the Babylonia zone, I'm taking you to Israel and that will be for you. He waits till Abraham gets there, he trusts God, goes there with his family, or whatever family he has. He has Sarah, he has his nephew Lot, and he has his servants. They all head on over there, and that's the moment when we start getting a lot of promises, and so let's take it away. This will be good if maybe we'll just go around the table. Can you just read? And you can read in maybe just read in English, but you have the Hebrew in front of you as well. You can follow in the language that you are happiest with. So source number one, Genesis 12:7. Would you like to read?
Okay. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, I will assign this land to your heirs. And he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him.
Okay, so as soon as Abraham gets there, God immediately promises this land to your heirs. Okay, that's very nice. And the word heirs is kind of a strange translation. I apologize. It's just the JPS blocked and pasted. But in the meantime, what's the Hebrew? Lizaracha. What does Lizaracha mean? Your seed, meaning your actual children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So from the very beginning, once Abraham arrives in the land, that's when God first gives the land of Israel as a gift, what we call the land of Israel. It's not called that yet, of course. But in the meantime, the land of Canaan that becomes called the land of Israel is being promised by God to Abraham from the very, very beginning. Of course, what's Abraham thinking, even though he doesn't say anything about it yet? I don't have any kids. And that's going to be the running theme of the rest of the whole Abraham saga, right? That it's going to be quite some time until Abraham figures out who the heir is going to be. At first,
the difference between heirs and Sarah, that's particularly the difference.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be your own seed.
That's exactly right. And in fact, Avraham is thinking like the JPS translation. Since my wife Sarai is 60, well, at this point it's still Sarai. My wife Sarai is 65 years old and barren, I'm not going to have children. And therefore, Lot is the obvious guy, my nephew. In other words, it's going to be an heir rather than my seed. You're exactly right. And I'm sure maybe that's why the JPS tries to fumfa a little bit, because they know the story and they're trying to get it that way. But then Lot makes the worst choice of his life, a parak later, when he says, look, I'd rather get really, really rich than live in the land of Israel with my uncle Abraham. And the place to get rich in those days was Sodom, if you're not going to move to Egypt. And Sodom was wealthy for the same reason Egypt was wealthy. And that's what Lot found attractive about it, namely rising Jordan River. So it was fertile all the time, predictably. The land of Israel depends on rainfall. This is not just a climate discussion, although it is. It's one of the axioms of the Torah. The Torah really cares about the fact that the land of Israel is dependent on rainfall and not on the predictable rising and falling of the Nile River or the Jordan River. So Lot went to Sodom because it was like Egypt. And this brings us to source number two. Once he makes that terrible choice, because it was a wicked place. Okay, so we move on to source two. Would you like to read? If we could just move around the table, I think it'll be easier.
This
yeah. Two, yeah. When it says Genesis 13, 14 to 17.
Okay. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, raise your eyes and look out from where you are to the north and south, to the east and west. For I give all the land that you see to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. Up, walk about the land through its length and its breadth, for I give it to you. And Abram moved his tent and came to dwell at the terebinths of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and he built an altar there to the Lord.
So Abraham continues to trust that God must be telling him something real, right? That you're going to have children of your own, and they're going to create a family, and that family is going to inherit the land. And that's after Lot leaves. You understand that Abraham might be thinking, oh, great, I don't have Zerah, I don't have offspring, and now I don't have any heir at all. So God is like, don't worry, everything is going to be fine. Although poor Abraham has to suffer along with Sarah for a while until they figure it out. Yeah.
Any reason for the use of the word dust rather than stars? It sounds sort of negative.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those are the two things that we get to be, the dust of the earth and the stars of the heaven. And there's all kinds of wonder. I mean, you understand the idea of many. Here's a cool fact. If you're an ancient person and don't have a telescope and you're standing on a mountaintop in a new moon and there's no light pollution and you have fabulous vision, how many stars can you see, assuming ideal conditions?
Galaxies.
With your naked eye, you can see between 1 and 2,000 stars. That's it. It's shocking. Isn't that cool? I mean, there are billions and billions of them, but that's what the astronomers can tell us because they have great sophisticated equipment. If you don't have that great sophisticated equipment and you're just an ancient person, again, with the ideal eyesight and all the perfect, no light pollution at all.
I
was there, I saw one of those really cool meteor showers. Yeah. That was thoroughly awesome. I have terrible eyesight, thank God. But in the meantime, with my glasses, thank God for everything, but that includes the stuff that you're not pleased with, but that's just the way that you are, so you deal. But in the meantime, we're supposed to think, the Talmud tells us that. That all being said, it seemed to me like infinite stars. There's no question about that. It was awesome. But the astronomers who have taken the trouble to actually... I can't do that. I get dizzy. But in the meantime, these guys, that's what they do, right? So they do that for a living. They tell you between 1,000 and 2,000 stars are visible to the naked eyes. That's the most Avraham would have seen. However, if you've been at Mitzpah Ramon, especially during that cool meteor shower, it feels like a lot more. And clearly, that's the import. God isn't saying, may you have 1,000 to 2,000 descendants, right? He's saying, may you have many, 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 because it seems infinite. But as opposed to grains of sand, there really are a lot of them on your standard beach, right? It's a lot more than 1,000 to 2,000 that you would be able to accumulate even in just a regular sandcastle situation, let alone the entire beach. The bottom line is, so there are homiletical interpretations about how that works, that we're unified like the dust, but each one of us is so individual. There are all kinds of lovely things that commentators have made of the two imageries, but you understand that both of them are fundamentally good. The idea is that you're going to have a huge family. You know, now, for our next trick, we have to do that, right? The people of Israel, we've always been a tiny people, always. We were then, we are now. It's an amazing thing that we've never reached the star-like or dust-like proportions that these blessings set out. That all being said, okay, God keeps on promising and Avraham keeps on wondering, and that brings us to source three. This is what we call the Brit Ben Abtarim, the covenant between the halves, where God makes a unilateral promise to Avraham that his descendants will inherit the land of Israel, having first gone to become slaves in the place that you and I know to be Egypt. Okay, so that brings us to three.
On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Avraham, saying, to your offspring I assign this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates.
Okay, so you get the sense that every single time God and Avraham talk about anything, it seems to revolve around God promising Avraham yet again that your descendants will inherit the land. It seems to be very high on the agenda, yeah.
Is there a connection to why that he chose to use the word Zerah, and because he's talking so much about the land, that he planted seeds in the land?
What you're saying is great, and in fact, the prophet Hosea and others use that metaphor. The idea of God planting his people on the land comes up. The Nevi'im exploit that metaphor. I'm not sure, I mean, you could be right even here, I'm not sure if that's God's point here. It could be. But several prophets actually make that explicit. The idea of God implanting the people in, should I smile? She's taking a picture, yeah. Or should I just look natural? You know how these things are. In the meantime, I'll just keep doing my thing. In the meantime. So I don't know. It's a good point that it very well might be. But also, it does mean offspring. God is explicitly telling Avraham, despite all odds, you're going to actually have children. And that brings us to source number four. There's the commandment of the Brit Milah, the circumcision. And this is where God changes Avram's name to Avraham and Sarai's name to Sarah. Okay? Yeah, I think if we go around, it's way easier than asking for volunteers each time. So sorry that you're stuck. Don't worry, we'll get you guys in the back also. So,
I will maintain my covenant between me and you and your offspring to come as an everlasting covenant throughout the ages, to be God to you and to your offspring to come. I assign the land you sojourn in into you and your offspring to come, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting holding. I will be your God.
Okay, now this, it sounds like, here we go again, right? Not so fast, says Professor Yehuda Elitzur, whose name will come up a few times. Professor Elitzur was a fabulous Tanakh teacher in Israel. He died, I think, 1999. He's a relatively recent figure, who was one of really the great Orthodox models of bridging traditional scholarship. He was a diehard traditionalist. He taught at Bar-Ilan University, but he was very well acquainted with contemporary scholarship, and he was an expert in Israel, archaeology, geography. He really knew that stuff very well. So he wrote an essay on the land of Israel in Tanakh, and so I found it, thankfully, and so he added some ideas that I will be quoting periodically over this four-part series. He says, this is not like sources 1, 2, and 3. And he makes a very big deal about that, as a matter of fact. He says, this is a covenant. This is a statement of a covenant. It's not just God promising the land to Abraham's descendants. It's a covenant. And there are three axioms of this covenant, which he argues, and I probably would agree, here's a gift. One is a gift. There's no treaty. This is a covenantal relationship, an eternal covenant between God and what becomes the people of Israel that have give and take. In other words, that God is going to do things, but it's not just here's a gift. The first three occasions that we've read, God is simply saying, here, this is going to be to you and your descendants. This is a covenant where God is setting out that there's a mutual relationship with responsibilities. At the moment, it's just circumcision for Abraham, but giving of the Torah is going to flesh that out in a very big way. That that's going to be a mutual... Huh? I never make puns, so if you catch them, you know that they were accidental. But in the meantime, I heard it as I was saying it too, but they're never intended. The worst was the first sermon I ever gave. I was a student rabbi, and I was talking about slamming a hole in the Eved Ivri, you know, if he wants to remain a servant after 6 years. And I was coming to the punchline, and I was going to say it was a piercing reminder, and I promise I didn't mean that. And I winced from the pulpit, because I was like, oh man, everybody's going to think that was deliberate. And so some guy said, that was fantastic, that was really what a great one. I'm like, I didn't mean it, but okay, so be it. The giving of the Torah is the fleshing out of the covenant that God is now making with Abraham, where God is going to give certain things to the people of Israel, and the people of Israel are going to give certain things to God. Right? In other words, we have responsibilities in this covenant. It's not just a plain old, that's a very special present, but it's not just a unilateral, correct. There are very important strings. So that all being said, Professor Yehuda Elitzur argues that three of the most central principles of what the God-Israel relationship are all about are right here. One is that we're a chosen people, right? That here we are, that there's a covenant between God and Israel, right? Okay, that's a big deal. That there's an eternal covenant between God and what becomes the people of Israel. Number two, that God is going to be our God. It's an expression of the relationship with God and monotheism in general. Okay, so it's chosen people, monotheism. And the third part of the covenant is part that we care about for the next 4 weeks, the land. The land is no longer just a gift. The land is now a centerpiece of the God-Israel covenant, which is interesting because here we are sitting in Brooklyn, and I hope you all think, like I do, that the Torah is a covenant that transcends the borders of the land of Israel, and that's something that we all need to think about over the next 4 weeks in terms of how God got that to work. That even though the land of Israel is a central part of the covenant, this is not an off the Broadway thing. This is right smack dab in the middle of everything, and it's even lachuzat olam, which is interesting. There's going to be an eternal holding. Well, once again, let's just ask the question from the perspective of sitting in Brooklyn: did we hold it forever? What's God promising?
On and off forever.
We might have had a continual Jewish presence in the land, but I think that it's fair to say that there were large swaths of history where we were not the owners of the land in any political sense. There might have been some Jews there, like a few hundred, or whatever it's going to be. So in what way is it achuzat olam? I think that's a very pressing question that we need to address when we're learning the Torah.
The second part of the covenant, we haven't gotten to that yet. So for the covenant is one-sided so far. When we talk about the second part of the covenant, we lose when we don't hold up the other one.
Very good. So we're going to have to play that whole thing out. You're, of course, correct. That's what's going on over here, that there's another side to it, which is if we want to live in the land, well, then we got to be good. But the land belongs to us even if none of us are there. And that's what's happening in this covenant. And that's very important. And that's a theme that's going to keep coming up. And we'll develop different sides of that over the next few weeks. That's why it's good to have a four-week course instead of trying to do all this in one. 4 weeks was a very overwhelming task, but one would have been, oh man, what am I going to do? So it's important to understand this achuzat olam is not a trivial point of the covenant. The God is saying that from going forward, the land of Israel is going to belong to your descendants, whether or not you're there, even though he doesn't say that part at all, certainly not explicitly here, and I think that's critical. The conversation with the Avot sounds much more unilateral, that God is giving this land, and it sounds like it's always going to be ours for real, meaning that we're going to live there the whole time, and we only find out if you want to stay there, you better behave, and that's going to be a part that later books of the Torah will exploit. Now, this idea... Sefer Bereishit, I'm sure you notice this because you can't not. It hits you over the head. Never gets tired of mentioning God's covenant of the land to the people. Right? Right after the Akedah is the only place where God swears that covenant into, you know, it's almost like a ratification of the covenant, as it were, and that's in source number 5. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. He had seven other sons, yeah.
So his descendants are all those people.
Right. So let's backpedal to what I had to. That's why I started the shiur where I did for your question's reason, which is that the rest of Sefer Bereishit sets out who the chosen people really is. Meaning, it's not Avraham's family in the end. It's one branch of Avraham's family, and only by the end of Bereishit do you realize it's the children of Yaakov.
But that's not what is said from God to him in day one.
That is correct. If you just read the Avraham thing, I'm expecting all of Avraham's family will be what you and I call the chosen people. You're completely correct. The rest of Bereishit then modifies that. And that's how Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, who I prefaced with, I prefaced for that reason, because your point is absolutely correct. When you're looking at Avraham, it sounds like it will be Avraham's entire family.
But it's literally, it's Avraham's family.
No, no, no. But the book of Bereishit does that perception for us. There's no interpretation here. And so the book of Bereishit modifies it. It lets you know that God's covenant is with a particular branch. And the people in the story have to figure that out. As I mentioned, with Yosef and his brothers, I'm sure all of the brothers thought, oh no, here we go again. We're out, he's in. Right? That's what it seems like to me also as a reader. At that moment in the story, when Yaakov is having Yosef strut around with that coat, okay, it really sounds like Yosef is going to be the next link in this chosen people filtration process, and everybody else is on the outs. It really feels that way. And it's not until they reconcile at the end that you realize, ah, Baruch Hashem, they're all in. And that's what God, again, this is God's ratification at Har Sinai. That's when you see, okay, this is what it is, that the patriarchal covenant is Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that branch. Right? So that's not an interpretation. I think the whole Torah revolves around that point. But you're right. At this moment, you could not know that. In fact, Avraham doesn't know that. He thinks Yishmael is going to be his heir for a while. Right? Avraham is totally fooled. And God says, no, Yishmael will not be your heir. He's going to go through Yitzchak. God tells him that. And that's when his perception gets changed, as does ours. Okay, so source 5.
Avraham failed. I mean, Adam HaRishon failed. Noah failed. And God decided, I'm going to take a different approach, providing a person, a superior person, to be a model. He took the model approach. He expected everybody to be perfect.
100%. Abraham is a model. That's our job.
It didn't work.
Yeah, it still hasn't worked. Yeah.
But with Abraham, it's a different approach. Like a superior person as an example.
100%. That's the whole point. That's what Rav Avadia Sforno says. He says, God chose Avraham to make everybody like Avraham. He's supposed to influence everybody. He and his family are supposed to be a positive influence on humanity to bring all humanity back. That's exactly right, yeah.
Avraham did a lot of bad things also. He said that Sarai wasn't...
Yeah.
So why do we decide that malfeasances are okay.
That's a bigger shiur. Your questions are good, but that's an Avraham shiur. I can give a lot of series on that too. But that's not this series. In other words, the Torah. Look, I don't need to tell you. Tanakh sets out the axiom that other than my wife, nobody is perfect. Tanakh doesn't specify my wife, but that's obvious. You know, between the lines. But people are not. Even the greatest people are not perfect, right? And I'm glad that the Torah sets that out because that makes them real role models to us. If they were perfect and we're not, we would say, okay, fine, this is some fantasy land, which is great when you're 4 and really horrible when you're an adult and you realize that life is, or even a 10-year-old kid, and you realize life is complicated and these people don't seem to have any problems or shortcomings, we can't even relate to them. So I'm grateful that Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham Avinu, and all of our ultimate superheroes are great human beings, but human beings with that. I for sure that's correct. But he was still the best and by far. And that's what God is going for here. In other words, God is not expecting perfection. Well, God would like perfection, but God knows that people are capable of making errors. And in fact, the whole Torah is rigged in that, knowing that. Okay, so back to source 5.
The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I swear, the Lord declares, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your favored one, I will bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the heaven and the sands on the seashore. And your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes.
So you get your stars and your sand all rolled into one. So that's great. That all being said, you also get the only time that God swears. I mean, I take God's word the first bunch of times around also, but this is the moment that he swears, which is important because in Sefer Devarim, I think 9 or 10 times, it says, God, the land that God swore to your ancestors. This is the only place that explicitly you see the oath part. And so Sefer Devarim plays off of that a lot. Just as Moshe Rabbeinu at the Golden Calf, he said, you swore that you were going to... So he must be referring to this, because this is the only place where God actually makes such an oath, as opposed to just saying over and over and over again, as we have seen. So theme number one is that God is giving the land of Israel to Abraham's descendants through what turns out to be through Yaakov as a gift, as part of a covenant, and then there's an oath involved with it. Those are the three things that we have seen so far. The rest of Reshit really marches through how Yitzchak is going to be the one who is going to inherit this land. And then for a while, it's not clear that, and for all you know, Yitzchak is thinking, hey, I have twins, they're both from Rivka, maybe they both will they'll be part of this nation. And it takes some time to figure out Esav is not going to be part of this nation. And then Yaakov gets it. Yitzchak, as Yaakov is running away because Esav wants to kill him after the whole birthright thing. So Yitzchak pulls Yaakov aside and gives him Birkat Avraham, which is the land. Time and again, God promises Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Yitzchak tells Yaakov, everybody knows that the land of Israel belongs to this family branch and from an eternal divine promise. That's theme number one. Yeah.
So here it seems like it does have to do with offering his son, that was also part of what Avraham did to... Does that have to do with
the oath? Look, God promised the land from minute one. As soon as he walked into the land, this is yours, right? So you can't say that the Akedah is the only reason, but the Akedah seems to trigger this oath. Right. No, there's no question that somehow this act ratifies that Avraham Avinu really is so sensational. You earned it, but he had it anyway. But this kind of proves that he deserves it, kind of. That's the way the Akedah seems to write out. You're absolutely right that something new just happened, which is why I added, it's not in the source sheets. There are so many more sources I could put in that fit this theme. I think I did it fine with 5. I'm happy now. And so we can move on to the next thing, which is Tanakh also, particularly Sefer Bereishit, is very interested in times that our ancestors purchased land from other people. So the first time that happens is Avraham Avinu when Sarah dies. Okay, so source number 6, okay.
And Abraham rose from beside his bed and spoke to the Hittites and said, saying, I am a resident alien among you. Sell me a burial site among you, that I may remove my dead for burial. Let him sell me the cave of Machpelah that he owns, which is at the edge of his land. Let him sell it to me at the full price for a burial site.
Here the Hittites are like, no, you're a prince, take a gift. And then Ephron shows up, come on, take it for free. And Abraham is like, no, wait, do you know how much 400 shekel, which is what he paid, do you know how much that is? Your average annual income in those days was 10 shekel a year for a regular worker. So that's like, that 400 shekels was a ton of money. Okay, so he was rich, he had it, and he was able to afford it. But he didn't just pay... Huh? Well, Paro gave him a ton of wealth, and he was set. He was set after that whole thing, and then he also was a fine trader businessman with the locals. I mean, he really did. Obviously, was very successful at what he did. So he owned a ton of property, and by the end of his life, he was fine. That all said, this is an exorbitant. I mean, Ephron is like, sucker. I can't believe that he just shelled out 400 shekels for this. He's thrilled. But in the meantime, what matters is that Avraham bends over backwards to pay for the burial site. And the rest of Sefer Bereishit continues to emphasize that we bought it fair and square. Yaakov, even as he's about to die, says, make sure you bury me in the cave that Avraham bought. And then when Yaakov dies, they bury him in the cave that Avraham bought. The Torah likes this idea that we bought certain things. And the first place in Israel that we ever bought as a family for living people, as opposed to as a burial ground, was in Shechem. Yaakov, when he came back from an extended stay at Lavan, we go to source number 7.
Jacob arrived safe at the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, having come thus from Padan Aram, and he encamped before the city. The parcel of land where he pitched his tent, he purchased from the children of Hamor, Shem's father, for 100 gazitas. He set them up an altar there and called it El Elokei Israel.
And later on in Tanakh also, this purchase comes up again, just as a reminder that, we bought this fair and square, this land belongs to us. The only other place that we bought as a national treasure, besides Hebron burial and Shechem, was Harabayit. David purchased it. Even though he conquered the city, he could have just waltzed in there and said, okay, this is now mine. I'm the king and you're not. But he paid for it. And that's important also in source number 8. I chose the passage from Divrei HaYamim, from Chronicles, rather than from Shmuel, because Chronicles is already playing off of Bereishit. So that's what I wanted to show you in source 8. Okay.
I read it in Ifrit. ויאמר המלך דוד לארנן, לא כי קנו אקנה בכסף מלא, כי לא אשא אשר לך להשם העלות עולה חינם. ויתן דוד לארנן במקום שקלי זהב משקל 600.
Because he paid 600 shekels for Har HaBayit, so which is a much bigger, you know, he got a much better deal than Avraham, but Avraham didn't care. Avraham was willing to pay the money. But in Hebrew, it's Bechesef Male. So that's already playing off of what Avraham said to Ephron. He wants Bechesef Male, I want to do that. One other thing that Avraham said, going back to source number 6, before moving past, is that he says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, back in source number 6. I'm a sojourner, and I dwell here. That Ger v'toshav, it's such a weird combination. In other words, the people are calling him Nasi Elohim. The people say, you're a prince, because he was. He was an incredibly wealthy man, and plus a great man. They respected that. But he said, I'm just a stranger. I live here, but I'm a stranger. This expression, Ger v'toshav, that's our relationship, meaning the people of Israel's relationship to their land, becomes at the heart of understanding what it's about. That we live there, but we're God's tenants. In other words, the land actually never really belongs to us, and God constantly reminds us that in later passages in the Torah. The land never, we don't have a homeland in the modern European sense. It's very important to understand that, even though we call it our homeland. It's certainly the land of our ancestors, but it's not a homeland the way that modern European usage is all about. The land doesn't belong to us, according to the Torah. The land belongs to God, and therefore it's God's to give to us and to make it as an eternal part of a covenant, but it also means that God can evict us if we're not living up to the covenant. Right? It's not ours. We're really gerim v'toshavim. And so what Avraham says at the very get-go, the first moment of a land purchase that we own, he sets out what becomes an ideology later on in the Torah. Yeah.
So when Hashem gives us the land, it's not specified from where to where. No boundaries. So comes up later, I'm assuming.
Yes. The Torah defines, Torah does define the boundaries.
But not here.
Not here.
Right, I mean, right.
But that's still vague. That's kind of vague. But no, there are places in the Torah that give a map. No, the Torah gives a very clear map of what it should be. Yeah. When Moshe and the people are about to enter, God says, here are the borders.
So what we're buying, we're not in the borders? Or?
They were in the borders, but we didn't own anything yet. In other words, this is the land that was promised to future descendants, but it didn't belong to us yet.
I see.
So Avraham can't say, well, since God promised that we're going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years and be oppressed, I'm just going to take some land right now. It doesn't belong to him right now. And he needs to bury Sarah right now.
It would be great if they could find some bills of sale.
Yes. That would be awesome. Although the Midrash takes the Torah, of course, to be the bill of sale.
And it would have to be in Iraq.
The world, the people who don't accept our claim now won't accept it if we dig up Avraham Avinu's original contract. They won't care. Okay? So it would be, for the record, a really awesome document to find. I would be very happy to see it myself. But I don't think it would change anybody's political views in the slightest, okay? But the mid... They had... In the good old days, they did have deeds and contracts also. We found many Mesopotamian deeds and business deals, you know, just day-to-day business stuff with contracts and all that kind of stuff. It existed back then also. I don't know what Avraham did in this story, if they just handshake or some ancient Near Eastern equivalent. I don't know. But everybody understood this was Avraham's. And the Midrash says, nobody can ever say that we stole Hebron, Har HaBayit, or Shechem, because the Torah is explicit, or the Tanakh is explicit, that we purchased these things. That's another theme. Next, okay, that was theme number 2. That God promised the whole land, but when we come back from Egypt, we don't get it now, that's why the patriarchs have to buy stuff, right? But then that became a special purchase that Tanakh continues to make a deal about it, that there's something special about buying land in Israel. The third thing, which is not covered in the source sheets at all, because it would just be such an enormous source sheet situation. So I'm going to tell you about it, because you know the story. Parshat Vayetzeh, which runs from chapters 28 to 31 in the book of Bereishit. It's a long parasha, and you could view it actually as one big literary unit, which is something we're not going to do now because that requires a whole shiur on that parasha. Trust me for the day, but obviously don't really trust me. You can look it up yourself and work with it. But what you have, Rabbi Elchanan Samet, who's a Tanakh teacher nowadays, he lives in Israel, he argues that Vayetzeh can be broken into the first half and the second half. He breaks everything in Tanakh into the first half and the second half. That's what he does. But here it really works. The first half is where Yaakov has all of his children. Second half, he has no children. The first half, he has all these blessings and everything is just going great. He builds exactly the family he had hoped to build. In the second family, he earns a lot of speckly sheep, if you know that part of the story. He gets very wealthy with sheep, and that's it. So Rabbi Samet argues that there's a turning point in Parashat Vayetzeh. And that's where Lavan, after 14 years of Yaakov working his tail off to marry, well, all he really wanted out of the whole thing was Rachel, but he ended up with three other wives that he didn't want. And then he has, right? It's sad. It breaks my heart every time. I feel Leah's pain to the degree that I can. It really bothers me. And I feel bad for her kids who obviously feel their mother's humiliation and pain. Leah loved Yaakov, and I'm sure Yaakov would have loved Leah, but that's not who he loved. He loved Rachel. It's very sad. But what matters for us is, when after those 14 years, Yaakov has a family, he's done exactly what he set out to do, he's waited a long time, it's time to go home. You did it. You did what you set out to do. Your mission accomplished. Good for you. It's time to go back to Israel, see your folks, go back to the land of the covenant, reconnect with God. He even made a neder on his way out saying, if you protect me, I'll come back and I'll make this Beit Elohim and all these things. He made a vow saying he expects to return. And then Lavan says, well, I want you to stick around because you're an excellent shepherd. What are your wages? And that's when they come up with that whole speckly sheep thing. And Yaakov works for an additional 6 years at that point, during which Lavan and his family grow to hate Yaakov to the point where Yaakov has to flee. And then, in the end, sorry, Yaakov, for all that extra income that you made while you were away. Guess what he does as soon as he returns? He gives it all away to Esav. Talk about flushing 6 years right down the toilet.
It was, all.
Not all, but a lot. I mean, he was willing to give an immense amount of wealth. I don't know every single sheep here, of course. And Yaakov remained wealthy. It's not that he was destitute. But he gave an exorbitant gift to Esav, which, by the way, really worked. Esav suddenly gives him a big kiss, and that saga is over, which is terrific. I'm very relieved. The Rabbi Samet argues that there's nothing wrong with making a living. It's an admirable thing to do. But Yaakov isn't just a regular person who needs to feed his family. He's a man of the covenant. And he knows that God wants him back. And in fact, God tells him finally, go back to Israel already. Go back home. And what God is saying is, okay, there's a covenant to be fulfilled, and you're lingering beyond that which is necessary. And I think that's something which is an important value that's going to come across in our fourth, meaning I got to set the stage for the whole thing here, so I'm going for it. In the fourth session, where you have this unusual occurrence that we'll talk about more there, where after the exile in Cyrus, okay, this is already week four of the four-part series, permits the Jews to go back, a tiny fraction of the Jewish community goes back, and most of them remain in Babylonia by choice. In other words, they're not held there, they're not in prisons, they're not slaves, they're free. In fact, probably many of them were quite well-to-do, and that's probably why they chose not to return. But I think that that's an important element that's being foreshadowed here, that Yaakov himself chose to remain in exile over going back to Israel, even though there was no genuine reason to do so. And that's something to think about, and that's something that we'll bring back up in week four. But I'm in Bereishit now. I got to set the stage for everything. So that's that. Now we're back to our source sheets. End of Yaakov's life. Yaakov is now in Egypt. I still think that's one of the greatest lines ever, where the venerable Yaakov comes in to greet the great Paro. And Paro takes one look at him. He's like, man, you are so old. How old are you? And then in the saddest response ever, it's like, I'm 130 and I've had such a miserable life. Right? It's heartbreaking. But of course, you know that he's telling the truth because you've read all the stories up until that point. So now Yaakov, at least, and thank God for all that miserable life, at least he's with Yosef again and the family is reunited. It's a very happy, albeit tormented story, but the end is at least good. So now Yaakov realizes he's close to dying, and this brings us to source number 9.
Yaakov lived 17 years in the land of Egypt, so that the span of Yaakov's life came to 147 years. And when the time approached for Israel to die, he summoned his son Yosef and said to him, do me this favor, place your hand under my thigh as a pledge of your steadfast loyalty. Please do not bury me in Egypt. When I lie down with my fathers, take me up from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. He replied, I will do as you have spoken. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed at the head of the bed.
So, you know, Yaakov and Yosef, they really do love each other. It's a very beautiful relationship. They had that 22-year hiatus, but now they're right back together. There's something just fabulous about that moment where they reconcile. And you could just imagine the passion of the kiss and just knowing that they're together again, that, and Yaakov knowing that his son is alive, right? All good things. And then Yaakov says, I want to be buried in Israel. And Yosef is, sure, Dad. And then Yaakov says, swear to me. Huh? What's up with the swear part? Like, you don't think that he trusted Yosef? And not, why does he make him swear?
Because it's important in Egyptian culture, and this way the power couldn't say, well, with a swear, you got to do it.
Very good. So were you going to say the same thing? Okay. Also very good. Well, Rashi and Ramban say the same thing. That they, of course, Yaakov trusts Yosef, but he doesn't trust Paro. So he knows that Paro doesn't want Yosef to go anywhere, even for a little while. Yosef saved Egypt, after all, and he does run the country, and he's doing a terrific job. You don't want him to just go and take a vacation, albeit just to bury his own father. But if he says, oh, my father made me swear, Paro respects that. Okay, you swear by your own God, that's it. You better do it. Okay, and to corroborate what both of you were going to say, we get to source number 10. After Yaakov dies...
Okay, and when the waiting period was over... Wailing period was over. Joseph spoke to Pharaoh's court, saying, do me this favor and lay this appeal before Pharaoh. My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. Be sure to bury me in the grave which I have made ready for myself in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, let me go up and bury my father, then I shall return. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you promise on earth.
So, on earth. Very good. So that's why Rashi and Ramban say, they're not even speculating. Okay, Pharaoh respected the oath. That's great. So, in comes Rabbi Shlomo Riskin from Efrat. I know him from the west side from when I was a kid, but in the meantime, now more recently from Efrat. And he asked a very interesting question that I missed. I always liked Rashi and Ramban and continue to do so, but he catches an element in the story that they seem to overlook, and that is, in source 10 that you just read, it says that Yosef spoke to Paro's court, meaning, who did Yosef speak to?
Himself.
Underlings. He didn't go to Paro.
That's right.
He went to...
Right. Mishnah
Lamelech. He is Mishnah Lamelech, but that's why I'm expecting that he went to Paro. And in fact, in my mental mind, because we all have a movie in our head, don't we? Mm-hmm. I do too. My movie is that Yosef went to Paro and said it, because that's what he would do. He is number two in the kingdom. He can have an audience with Paro. I'm sure he may need to request it and follow the court protocols, but he can get in there if he needs. I mean, slaves get into a wicked Paro. When Moshe and Aaron go in there, it's amazing that they're just allowed to waltz right into the palace like that. It's incredible, actually. Right? Huh?
Why does he speak to the underlings?
Does he speak to the underlings? Why doesn't he go to Paro? Yeah.
He doesn't want the underlings to cause a problem. This is the way he's explaining it to them, because Paro may go and speak to them, or not speak to them, or just tell them, and they'll say, hey, Joseph may not return. But this way, he wants to make it easier.
So very good. So Rabbi Riskin takes a different slant, but I like your slant as well. Rabbi Riskin suggests that there's something deeper going on here. It's not just that Yaakov doesn't trust Paro. Which is what Rashi and Ramban say. It's that he's worried about Yosef. Yosef has made himself into an Egyptian. He is Egypt, besides Paro. Paro really is Egypt, but Yosef is Egypt. After all, I mean, let's think about this for a minute. His name is Tzafnat Paneach now. It's not Yosef anymore. We call him Yosef, but he goes by the Egyptian name that we have in source number 11. Why don't we read source number 11, and you can just see Yosef. It's beautiful. You know what I love? Like, going back to Leah and her misery. So I imagine she's miserable. If you're writing a novel, you would probably be able to go to town imagining what she's feeling as she loves Yaakov and knows that will never be returned. But the one voice that the Torah gives to her is what she names her children, right? Reuven, oh, behold the son, maybe my husband will love me. Oh, God heard my sadness, that one after the other. And you feel, oh my goodness, the poor thing. Like, she's naming her own sons, whom she loves more than anything, after her misery. Like, she feels that longing for the husband, that she knows it will never be returned. So, yeah, Yosef also names his two sons, and you actually get a good angle into his identity here. So let's read source number 11.
Pharaoh then gave Joseph the name Sofnath Paneach, and he gave him for a wife Osnath, daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On.
Okay, so Yosef made it. He goes from prison to second in command. He's now an Egyptian. He marries a daughter of the priest. He really, I mean, talk about just making it overnight. It's not just that he has a good job. It's now he's married into the top echelons of Egypt, and he has an Egyptian name. He's an Egyptian, okay.
Thus Joseph emerged in charge of the land of Egypt. Before the years of famine came, Joseph became the father of two sons whom Asnath, daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the first son Menashe, meaning God has made me forget completely my hardship and my parental home.
So you see, what does he name Menashe? That he made me forget my lousy family. I'm an Egyptian now. The name Menashe reflects an identity struggle that Yosef has. It's nobody's imagination. Yosef says it explicitly in the Torah, and you get a window into how he feels about being an Israelite who suddenly is in Egypt. He said, thank God I forgot my lousy family situation. What a disaster. They hated me. They sold me into slavery. I'm an Egyptian now. That's what Menashe means, that God made me forget Israel.
We also learned that Yosef kept his language.
I'm sure he knew Hebrew, and in fact, that's what the brothers didn't realize, that he understood them, right? And as he remembered his language.
That at one point he doesn't let Egypt permeate the threshold of his home.
I'm all in favor of that. He definitely protects Israel's identity by living in Goshen. I'm all in favor of that. But all the same, Yosef on a person, you know, one doesn't have to take away from the other. Yosef experienced a very deep identity crisis that you get seen is reflected through his two sons. One is that, oh, Baruch Hashem, I'm an Egyptian now. He forgot his past, but thankfully he had a second son. If it would have stopped at one, it would have been a disaster. Carry on.
That second, it means he didn't forget.
Right, the second one, we'll read
and
it on.
The second he named Ephraim, meaning God has made me fertile in the land of my affliction.
The name Ephraim means that he hates Egypt. The land, he calls Egypt the land of my affliction. So here you really see Yosef's conflict. On the one hand, he's really an Egyptian now. Egyptian name, Egyptian wife, he's into the priesthood. And Menashe reflects that. It's like, oh, Baruch Hashem, I'm an Egyptian now, and I'm not Israel anymore. I've forgotten my past. And then the second son, Ephraim, he's homesick. He calls Egypt the land of my affliction. It's beautiful, right? It's right there in the text. My father actually suggested, he didn't know Rabbi Riskin's thing, he gave a sermon many years ago, he suggested that's the real reason Yaakov blessed Ephraim better, right? Because Ephraim represented the family connection, right? Okay, so the real truth is, as a firstborn, I'll just say it very bluntly, firstborns always lose, you know it. Read Tanakh, you will know the firstborn never is going to win, and therefore, of course, Ephraim is going to win. It has nothing to do with the names. With that all said, the name Ephraim certainly resembles what Yaakov would want to hear. That really reflects, oh, Yosef still remembered home. He remembers who he really is. Yeah.
I see it differently. I see that he forgot the pain of his family, but not his family, because he says God has. And the God is, I don't know, I see that as what he got from his family.
You could read it differently, but I think the translation is a fair one, right? Ki nashani Elohim et kol amali, all of my struggles, ve'et kol beit avi, God made me forget my family. You could read it otherwise. I agree with you. Biblical syntax gives you that.
Excuse me. What about with Ephraim, the pay and the resh of separation? Would that be that Ephraim, in a sense, separating him from this whole assimilative potential?
It's very nice. That I can't answer. In other words, I don't know if that's really what the name means in its origin, or if that's what, you know, later rabbinic spins on that, which are good. I like rabbinic spins too. But it's important, at least in terms of what the plain sense of the text, what's the text conveying. I think it is fair to say Yosef is experiencing a very deep identity crisis here. Yaakov knows that, going back to the question of why Yosef went to the underlings. And Yaakov knows that Yosef is afraid to look Paro in the eye and say, I want to bury my father in Israel. No, he's afraid to do it. If he goes to Paro and looks Paro in the eye and says, I want to bury my father in our homeland, that means he has to admit that he's an Israelite. And he's afraid to do that. He's developed this identity as an Egyptian for so long and so prominently that he can't do it. So he goes to the underlings. And that's why Yaakov says, swear to me. I'm really not sure. I think it's a fascinating insight. And again, whether or not that's what Yaakov is thinking, I think it is true to Yosef's personality, which is why it's important at the very, very end of Yosef's life in source number 12. Okay, now we can get...
I have a suggestion before that. It's just interesting that you said that God ended up swearing to Abraham that he would give him the land, and now Yaakov in return is making his son swear to bring him back to the land. So it's like also that mutual relationship.
I think that's a great suggestion. I think you're right. I think that you have the sense of God swore it to us, but now we kind of swear it back. I think that's beautiful, actually. I just want to note this for the record. Because if I don't... Okay, very good. Okay, Yosef at the very end of his life, you can appreciate all the more if Rabbi Riskin is right, what he says at the very end of Sefer Bereishit. Would you like to, do you have the...
I don't have it on the phone.
Okay, so here, so.
It's a little hard.
Okay, yeah.
Number 12. Okay. At length, Yosef said to his brothers, I'm about to die. God will surely take notice of you and bring you up from this land to the land that he promised on oath to Abraham, to Yitzchak and Yaakov. So Yosef made the sons of Israel swear, saying, when God has taken notice of you, you shall carry up my bones from here.
This is where Yosef finally decides. At the end of the day, I'm on my deathbed. I'm with you. Right? In other words, you really see this decisive moment. It's like, I'm going to be buried in Egypt. There's no way in the world we can get permission to bury me in Israel right away. But when we come back, when God redeems our people, I'm coming with you. Because I belong with you. And by the way, afterthought, Moshe Rabbeinu, as you know, is the one who personally attended to that. But at the very end of the book of Yoshua, you find out that Yosef is buried in Shechem, exactly where Yaakov had purchased the land, which is in the tribal inheritance of Yosef. Yeah.
Is this where we get the notion, the idea that if somebody is buried outside of Israel, the only way you can move a body to Israel? In other words, you can't move a body from one cemetery to another, but you can move it to Israel?
On average, there's no question that being buried in Israel is something that is very special, and there's no question that it goes back to Yaakov and Yosef being very adamant about that point. Right? In other words, I mean, there they have the advantage of mummification, so their body, I mean, nowadays we have preservation also. But there were periods in the middle that if you weren't a mummy and you weren't refrigerated like today, you wouldn't do it because, well, that's just not be kavod hameit. Whereas nowadays we actually can do that, going back to the origins of this. Yeah.
Was there any way that Yosef could bypass being embalmed, or it had to?
I don't see how. I mean, look, I don't know, but I don't see how in the world he could have avoided that. I mean, he was such an Egyptian, and he would have gotten all the royal honors for being. Look, Yaakov got all the royal. He's a mummy. Like he got embalmed also. I mean, I don't know mummy, but I don't know if it was every person, but at least nobility. I mean, Yaakov and Yosef are nobles, so they got that. So to summarize this segment. So we've gone through Bereishit, or at least some of the critical passages. What we've seen today is that God gave the land to Abraham as soon as Abraham entered the land, and that goes through the family branch of what becomes Yaakov and his sons. Later on, it becomes a central part of the covenant, right, in the Brit Milah passage. We see that God then swears the land after the Akedah, and that just becomes part of the package also. The Torah definitely makes a fuss about places that we bought, real estate that we bought in the land of Israel. The Torah focuses on how Yaakov, by choice, remained in exile for 6 years simply to make more money rather than for, you know, for persecution or to avoid Esav or anything like that. Strange, and probably, you know, God criticizes him for that. We talk about the identity of Yaakov and Yosef, the idea of burial in the land of Israel, and that Yosef himself wasn't really sure where he stood, and neither was Yaakov sure until finally he got the oath, and then Yosef followed through. But by the end, Yosef realizes where he belongs, and that's where he was, that's where he actually was buried. We're going to end with one point for now, and then we'll pick this all up next time. That going back to the Achuzat Olam point, that God promised all the way back in source number 4 that the land of Israel belongs to the people of Israel forever. Well, not only here we are, but the Torah regularly threatens exile to the people from the get-go. Not in Bereishit. Bereishit, that's not part of the agenda. But you get to Vayikra and Devarim, the things that we'll talk about next time. And God regularly says, if you don't keep my commandments, you'll have a series of woes first. You don't get exiled right away. But exile is the worst thing that could happen. That's the pinnacle of the curses. That's true in Vayikra chapter 26, Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, and a lot of other places too. It's really an ongoing theme, which sets out what somebody suggested earlier, and with this we'll close, that God is making an amazing promise here. He says, the land of Israel belongs to the descendants of Yaakov, regardless of whether they're in the land or not. The land always belongs to our people, but if you want to live there, you have to be faithful to the covenant. If you don't merit living there, then you will live out of there. But the land will always belong to you and you will always return. That is a basic axiom of the Torah, and the prophets take that for all it is worth. But it's important to hear that principle at the very end of the, at the very end of today.
But how does that work with the chosenness? Because anybody could be chosen in the world if they follow the monotheistic.
Sure.
Right. They could be chosen.
Sure.
How does that work?
They don't get the land of Israel, though. Huh? They live where they are, and they're chosen people, too.
Chosen means also getting the land of Israel.
No. For the land of Israel goes to the descendants of Yaakov. That was God's promise.
Different mechanism.
Correct. The chosen people and the land of Israel relate. What you're saying is very important. They relate, but they're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're the chosen people wherever we live, and the Torah is binding wherever we live, right? The covenant is on full time, right? But the land of Israel is something that needs to be merited if you want to live there. Mm-hmm. And that's something which is really important and something that will animate a good chunk of next week. On that happy note, I can't believe we're already done. How does that happen? But we are, and I